Welcome once again to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? I'm Ray in California, and he's Jim in New York. And Jim, when you and I served down under at the U.S. Embassy in Australia, we never talked about a thing called AUKUS because there was no thing called AUKUS. But now it is definitely a thing. And in fact, two of our biggest episodes, episode 20 with Jennifer Parker and episode 28 with Malcolm Turnbull, highlighted what has become quite a raging controversy about this thing.
Indeed. So to discuss that and see where we're going to go with AUKUS and what the future holds, we have with us our good friend and former colleague in Australia, Charlie Edel, who is the Australia Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the inaugural Australia Chair, I might add. Disclaimer, I am a senior advisor and chair of the Australia Advisory Committee for Charlie. So we've known each other for a while, and we like to think we goad each other to ever better ideas and thoughts. Charlie, welcome.
Jim, Ray, thanks so much for having me over. Really, really excited to be on this. As they say, long-time listener, first-time caller here.
Okay. Well, we're not going to be Howard Sternish about all this, but we'll do our best. Anyway, Charlie has a long resume, but the things to know besides his current position are he was a policy planning staff at State Department. He taught the U.S. Naval War College. He was at the U.S. Study Center in Sydney, and he wrote one of the best books I've read about sort of how to think about U.S. foreign policy, and the name always escapes me, The Triumph
the Tragedy. Of Tragedy.
It is a great book, and if I had him here, I'd show it to everyone, but he wrote that with Hal Brands, and it's a great book. Anyway, but we're not here to pitch Charlie's books and get his royalties. We're here to talk about AUKUS. So, Charlie, first question, as always, why should our listeners care about AUKUS now in this future and where it's going next or what happens with AUKUS?
Well, thanks, Jim. Your listeners should care about AUKUS because in many respects, it's the largest strategic muscle movement that the United States has made in the Indo-Pacific in the 21st century. And its success or failure will point the way forward for America's staying power, for its deterrent efforts, and for its ability and willingness to work closely to enable its closest allies to become more powerful than they are. I know that we've heard Richard Marles, the Deputy Prime Minister, talk about AUKUS as too big to fail. The consequences of its success or failure really will ripple forth, not only on the bilateral U.S.-Australian alliance, but to American equities much more broadly across the entire region and indeed globally. So I think from an American perspective, AUKUS matters not only because it's one of the largest moves that we've made, but because it really is a down payment for how we plan on reimagining our partnerships in the region, recharging our defense industrial base, and making sure that American allies who are more willing can become more capable. There's a suite of other reasons why we should care about AUKUS and its prospects for both the UK and Australia, but because all of us speak with funny accents, otherwise known as American accents, I thought I would start with why it matters for the US.
Well, so Charlie, let's take a step even further back and just, because I don't think we've ever really done this for our listeners, even though we've had a couple of different episodes and segments about AUKUS. What is AUKUS? Why is AUKUS? And how did it come about?
So let's see. What is AUKUS? How is AUKUS? And why did it come about, Ray?
Your questions? Basically, yeah. Okay. You know, well, why is there an AUKUS and how did it come about?
Okay. So what is AUKUS? AUKUS, that wonderful acronym that comes trippingly off the tongue, AUKUS, Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Right, a partnership, a defense partnership to do two different things. Number one, pillar one, to help Australia acquire, maintain, and build nuclear-powered, conventionally armed submarines, to replenish their fleet and to become, in many ways, more integrated, more interoperable with both the British and the American fleets. Pillar two, a consortium, a defense technological consortium to help, as Alessio Palatino at LSE in London has said, serve as a defense accelerator. We all know that in the military domain and strategic domain, but frankly in the economic domain, the competition in the 21st century is going to be won or lost by those countries who have comparative advantage in the advanced and emerging technology space. The UK, Australia, and the US do a ton of world-leading efforts here, and the thought is more and more partners is better than one. So how we can integrate efforts in this space. I think that when we zoom out, Ray, the point of AUKUS, why AUKUS, is how do we think about deterrence and how can we get better on our deterrent efforts vis-a-vis China? Because if we look at what China has steadily done as it's kind of plowed money into military modernization, if we look at how it's become much more assertive and indeed even aggressive in a number of locations, of course, across the Taiwan Straits, across the line of actual control with India, in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, in the Pacific, economically against Australia, we can say that for the most part, China has not yet been deterred from pushing the envelope further and further. SSNs, submarines, nuclear-powered submarines, are stealthy. They have range. They have loiter. They are hard, if not impossible, to detect. They are the best tool that we have in our toolbox to create deterrent effects. So pillar one, point one, is we need to understand how we can increase deterrence vis-a-vis China, and we get there by getting to more from the United States, more from Britain, and more from Australia in the first place. So that's what AUKUS is, or at least what it's intended to be. How did we get here, I think, was your second question. Let's remember, particularly because the debate is quite heated in Australia more than it is anywhere else, which makes absolute sense considering how central it is to their efforts. How do we get here? Australia needs to recapitalize its submarine fleet. Submarines are now getting life of type extensions. They saw them in half just to give them a couple more years. But Australia only has six submarines. You guys talked earlier with Jennifer Parker, who did a really great job laying this all out. They need to have undersea capabilities. And the ones that they've had, conventional submarines, diesel-powered subs, just simply aren't up for the 21st century. So number one, they need more. Number two, the Australians decided that they wanted to partner with the United States to get nuclear propulsion technology. And they reached out to the Brits first, and they made an argument, or several arguments, or very many several arguments, to convince the United States to do something that's only done once in our history, share what we call the crown jewels of our technology with our closest ally. We have not shared these with Australia. They've asked before. We have not shared these with any country who's asked before other than the UK some 40 plus years ago. So it came about through intensive and very secretive diplomatic efforts. I know most of the players who are involved, so do I. I got a ping from a very close friend late September of 2021, I think a day after AUKUS was announced, who said, "Sorry, I've been hiding from you. I've been in Washington for the last 3 weeks. I couldn't tell you why I was here." It surprised me. It surprised most of us. Obviously, it surprised the French.
I was the U.S. defense attaché to Australia up until 2020, and I had never heard of this thing.
Right. So that's what it was. But we should also say, too, and I'm sure we'll get into this in the conversation, that what it is exactly has evolved over time. Pillar one, the submarine efforts were the large part, but the pillar two efforts have really come along as we've gone. What actually you put in the bucket of advanced and emerging technologies has evolved. How Australia is going to acquire those submarines and advanced technologies has evolved. As I like to say sometimes, the way that we went about AUKUS with our partners is the exact opposite and backwards of how we normally do diplomacy. Jim, I'm sure, will correct me as the seasoned diplomat here, but normally, at least to my understanding, you spend a long time negotiating things, then you announce them when you get consensus. In some ways, we did the opposite of that with AUKUS. we announced it and then tried to figure out if we could actually pull it off. That's what the 18-month study run period was after that. And we're still figuring out how it can evolve to make sure that it's supported as it goes.
That's a great point, Charlie. And as you said, this is an incredibly complex and delicate thing to share our most advanced technology with another country. And we have these things called export controls on munitions, which are legislated by Congress, administered by the Department of State, and run by, frankly, a bunch of bureaucrats who say, I have to enforce the law. So it required a great deal of pushing and changes and goodwill, actually, to make those changes for AUKUS. And we've come a long way. I wouldn't say we're done. I'm curious what you think remains to be done. But it's a lot of progress. That said, a lot of concern about this being a multi-decade project and different administrations and different changes geopolitically, and the amount of money involved are all huge problems. But I want to get into the U.S. concerns, which we've seen occasionally, which is basically there's a shortage of U.S. submarines. We've seen an article just today by George Will in the Washington Post concerning our lack of submarines not being sufficient for the task. So how are we going to overcome this criticism in the U.S. from members of Congress and others who say, we simply don't have enough subs to sell some to Australia?
Yeah, no, it's thanks for bringing that up, because I think that what we saw was the United States is largely supportive of this. If you ask people, you know, are there criticisms or pushbacks of AUKUS here in Washington? The answer is no, we love the idea of it. We're just not sure whether or not we have enough subs to actually support it. And I think that this is actually a very legitimate question. Because the point is, do we have enough for U.S., no less allied efforts to play into the deterrence space? And the answer is no. The better question, or rather the next question should be, so how do we get to yes? The U.S. has global defense requirements, right? Set by the Congress, you shall have X many aircraft carriers, X many destroyers, X many nuclear-powered submarines. I see the garbage truck is coming by your house, Jim. That's it. That's the beeping. It's not the warning symbol or anything.
It's actually the septic system. The septic guy came just today.
What could possibly go wrong?
And I think that's entirely appropriate for our discussion.
Not at all. Not at all. Circling back to the point here. Circling back to the point is, do we have enough submarines? And to meet our U.S., first of all, global requirements. And the answer is no, we do not currently, because we are not building them. We are not procuring them at the rate with which they were required. We're supposed to be doing this at two submarines per year. That is acquiring, building, and then acquiring two submarines per year to make sure that we have enough submarines. Because of a number of factors, but largely because of workforce factors, COVID factors, supply chain factors, we can't actually build them as quickly as we need them. Everyone agrees that this is probably, as I said, the best tool that we have in our toolkit for not only global presence, but global deterrence, what we're talking about. But we're only building them at the rate of somewhere between 1.2 to 1.4 per year. So the question becomes, in a crisis, would we want to have them in the hands of our allies by selling them to them, or would we want to have them all in U.S. hands? That's what the debate in the U.S., I think, has largely revolved around. I tend to think that the better question here is not whether or not we're going to sell them doesn't make sense, but how do we get to more? How do we get to more, both for the United States and for our closest allies? And to my mind, when I kind of survey the landscape of the debate, there is not a better alternative that's been put forward than the vehicle of AUKUS to producing more assets. And for evidence, here I draw on the fact that not only has AUKUS been a useful battering ram for the U.S. Congress to get more into the submarine industrial base for the United States. And here we're talking really sizable investments. We're talking you know, depending on how you count and which supplementals actually materialize, but we're talking somewhere between $12 and $17 billion that the United States has put forth for the submarine industrial base just over the next couple of years. That is a marked change from where it was before, and I think it rides on the back of AUKUS. If we look at where the UK and where Australia have gone to, we see a commensurate level of efforts. And then really interestingly, because this is an Australian ask, this is something the Australian government wants, and they want to make sure that the United States can produce enough submarines so that they actually acquire them, we're seeing really significant investments by Australia into the United States and into the UK. So again, I think it's an entirely legitimate question to ask whether or not we have enough to serve US needs first and foremost, and those of our allies and partners as well. But the secondary question becomes, how do we speed them up? How do we get more money and resources to this? And to my mind, AUKUS is the best vehicle there. Although, as you said, we're not where we need to be yet.
Well, so that logically brings us to the other side of the coin, which, of course, is the Australian side, and the objections raised most prominently by, of course, Malcolm Turnbull, who was on, again, on episode 28 with us and talked about this. And the language that he brings up is out of the 2024 National Defense Authorization Act, which says, in part, not later than 270 days prior to the transfer of a vessel under authorized under subsection A, the president shall submit to the appropriate congressional committees and leadership a certification that the transfer of such vessels will not degrade the United States undersea capabilities. And so what Turnbull says is Australia is bearing the risk of a U.S. failure to meet its submarine production timelines. So if the U.S. doesn't meet the timelines, the U.S. still gets to keep the submarines. Australia now has given away its the previous submarine deal it had with France and is now entirely reliant on the U.S. president at the time saying, I certify that we've got enough ourselves. Is he right?
No, I don't think he's right for a number of different reasons. But let me also just note at the outset, Ray, that this is one objection, but it's only one of several objections that have been raised in the Australian debate. And I think it's really important that we talk about as many of them as possible, because you can't simply sweep concerns under the carpet, particularly when we're talking about extraordinary efforts, extraordinary expenditures. You know, this is something that there's been a critique that I actually find quite powerful, that all three governments, the Australians might bear the lion's share of blame here, but Washington and London get some too, have not been proactive enough in talking about why this is a big deal, why it matters, and why they're going to answer and meet the challenges. Again, these are somewhat striking and extraordinary efforts that all three governments are making. And the strategic case, I think, has to be somewhat consistently put before the American public, before the Congress or the legislatures of all three countries, because otherwise you simply cannot justify the efforts and the expenditures here. So I have no problem with public debate, and I actually find it fruitful, even if it's quite heated, as we know, in the Australian sense, and find that there's some real fodder in the charge that the governments have not been on their front foot making the case. Okay, so all that is to say, thank you for this podcast. We should do this again, and we should do this consistently, and maybe you should do this with someone who's in the government too. Okay, on to former Prime Minister Turnbull's critique that isn't this ceding Australian capability acquisition to the whims of a U.S. administration in the future. Look, the parts of his critique that I find are relevant and biting is, yes, there's a caveat here, as there are with all defense contracts on this. Frankly, I would point out that the contract that the Australian government had with the French contained just such a clause where they could get out at some point, as indeed they did. So number one, caveats are normal on such things as these. Number two, Australia needs new submarines, and it does not have the capability to build them, nor build them quickly, and it wants to have nuclear propulsion submarines because they have better capabilities. Where else is it going to get them from? So this is an important thing about Australia doesn't make these yet, so it needs to get them from somewhere else. But point three, and I think this is really critical, is I think the logic that Prime Minister Turnbull brought up makes sense, but there's something of a counting problem here that he has and that a number of people have. That when we're talking about the U.S. president's ability to certify that the United States has enough submarines in its sheds before it starts selling them, not giving them away to others, there are a lot of ways that you have submarines afloat and under the sea. Number one is by cranking them out of Groton and Virginia, obviously, having them roll off the production lines. The second part, though, is making sure that when those submarines need to get maintenanced and serviced, they can get that maintenance and service quickly and be put back out to sea. Optimally, the U.S. Navy says that at any given time, roughly 20% of U.S. Submarines are in the maintenance depot. Currently, the U.S. has northwards of 33% of its submarines being maintenance. That means that they're out of the water for somewhere between 6 months and several years because there's a backlog on maintenance issues. Now, if you can speed up maintenance, we have more submarines in the water doing their patrols, showing the flag, and providing the deterrence efforts that we need. One of the ways, one of the innovative ways, I think, that AUKUS is going to contribute to this is to speed up maintenance by putting another maintenance depot in Australia, in Western Australia, in Fremantle out of HMAS Stirling. If that comes online in the way that we're looking to, and frankly, we just had a tender out there, Australian submariners, civilians, and military are being trained in how to do this. Think about the number of extra submarines that are going to be freed up for this. So again, I don't think that the former prime minister's concern is an unfounded one, that this leaves it to the U.S., but I think it ignores the fact that AUKUS is actually enabling and freeing up more resources to be put in the water.
The other thing the prime minister said as a criticism was, we don't need nuclear-powered subs, because if we had more conventional subs, we could basically do the same thing for a lot less.
I'm sorry, I think you meant respond, Edel. And I think the response is...
yes, I was shocked in the silence too.
Well, look, Jennifer Parker, I think, did a really wonderful job of explaining this on episode 21, or I forget which episode it was.
20.
Okay, thank you.
Shout out to Jennifer.
The point is, fundamentally, conventionally powered submarines and nuclear powered submarines do not do the same things. One is faster than the other. One is stealthier than the other. One can loiter in a place much longer than the other can. And when we think of the enormous expanse of maritime bluescape that Australia needs to cover and patrol, one will meet their needs much better than the other. For a variety of reasons, Australia had not gone down that path before. Although, frankly, the French submarine deal that they were embarked on was quite complicated because it was to take a nuclear design ship and make it retroactively a conventionally designed ship. But I think that from most naval strategists' perspective, there is no comparison between conventional and nuclear-powered submarines. They're just fundamentally different types of platforms, and one gives you a lot more oomph, a lot more distance, a lot more coverage, and a lot more stealth than the other one can.
I'd like to, this is a really important conversation, but I do want to turn to pillar two, because it is certainly the less known pillar, but many consider it to be maybe in many ways the more important pillar. Let's just begin with kind of a recapitulation of, what pillar two is, this consortium you talked about, and why it is considered to be so important by so many.
Yeah, so what is it? It's a grab bag of advanced technologies that the three countries can work on collaborating together that can enhance their innovative capacity and get more capacity to warfighters, get them more deterrence. Now, when we zoom out for a second, Ray, I think it's important to fundamentally understand why Pillar 2 developed and in some ways accelerated past Pillar 1, although it's not had that much to show, although it's not had nothing to show. Submarines are great, but they're also, as you have noted, quite expensive and take a long time to build. And it's not like the United States and Australia and the UK have a deterrence problem that maybe might materialize sometime around 2035 or 2027 or 2042. We have a deterrence problem that's staring us in the face yesterday. And so I think really what Pillar 2 is intended to do is not only help us three nations kind of develop and innovate our way into the leading edge of technology, but to pour more things into the deterrence bucket that can be actualized and come online sooner rather than later. You know, the Brits always talking about minding the gap as you step into the underground. That's, I actually think, for the most part, what Pillar 2 was originally intended to do. Sometimes, to my ears at least, it gets a little convoluted when we begin talking about designing a seamless ecosystem where all three countries can acquire and innovate together. That's important. It's really quite challenging, as Jim has already noted, about the regulations that we need to knock down and align, I think, to do this. But fundamentally, at its core, AUKUS is a bet about deterrence, and deterrence means getting more things to more people's hands more quickly. So that's what I have always thought and understood Pillar 2 to be. Now, what Pillar 2 is exactly beyond the kind of headline of advanced and emerging technologies has changed and evolved over time. At first, it was kind of an afterthought on the initial announcement. Then we got four categories of things it would be. Then we got 8 or 10 or 12, depending on how you count. And now it's kind of necked down a little bit beyond that. The main ones, of course, are types of capabilities that we're looking at into the future. AI, quantum, undersea, autonomous systems. There are a variety, electronic warfare. There are a variety of different things that we're talking about. But we've begun to see some results come out of this already. The two I would flag at the outset that we've seen some notification of, but we're likely to see more, are other things in the undersea area that happen to be autonomous. So kind of think about undersea drones. Both the development of systems, their use, including kind of the launching of them through torpedo tubes, and the coordination of those systems together. A second area that's really quite interesting, you can't reach out and touch it, but that doesn't mean that it's not just as impactful, is using AI algorithms, particularly with sonobuoys that are put in the water by all three countries to talk to each other so that we have more coverage and we can see jointly what's happening. There's now new algorithms that we're using that they're trialing and testing to understand more of the seascape that they're operating in. Because, of course, in the underwater domain, you have to see what's there. You have to know what's there before you can actually move on it.
So this is getting a little of the weeds, but how is this coordinated? Is there a trilateral commission that decides, yes, that company has something we're interested in? Or is it organic? Companies talk to each other and go to the government? How are they proceed if I'm a guy with a drone shield idea?
Well, it's evolving, Jim. I think for the most part, has this coordinate itself within government first? They've set up kind of standing committees that look at this, both Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, and then have working groups beyond that. So the governments are more synced, more institutionally tied to each other than they had been previously. In terms of if you are a company that makes stuff or is looking to make stuff, how do you kind of input to the system? How do you even know what the system wants and how do you access that? That's where I say things are evolving. They've had some AUKUS investors networks. The governments have briefed companies, both some of the major primes, but also some of the smaller and medium enterprise shops about this. But I think one of the challenges that they found thus far is how do we make sure that this is not simply a top-down government requires and wants you to develop on X? And we've seen some of that, right? There was a contest put out for who can develop into the electronic warfare space. But also, how can those who are dynamic, those who are the innovators within our system, who are actually moving at the forefront of this and ahead of government in many ways, tell government what they have and feed it in? And that is something that is, I think, evolving, this kind of investors network, this consortium of companies coming together to be briefed about what the requirements are, but it's not there yet. And so one of the things that I hear pretty consistently, I know you do too, Jim, is we'd like a little bit more from the government about what it is that they are looking for. And frankly, we'd like to have a platform where we can say, you have not heard of this, but you should be thinking of this as well. You know, above all that, I'd say one of the coordination problems that we have had and will continue to have to a certain degree is it's great to collaborate. It's really good to innovate, but companies don't do this for free. And governments, of course, have national champions that they want to advantage over others. So this becomes a bit of a challenge, I think, about, you know, let's say that Britain has platform A, and wants to make sure that, you know, the U.S. and Australia acquire it, but Australia has a great platform C. So how this actually gets worked out, how things get tagged as AUKUS as opposed to simply an Australian project, and where they find the money for this, those are, I think, some of the key challenges they're still working through here.
Well, if it's going to be hard with three countries involved, what are the prospects for more countries to be involved? And we've heard a lot about this, I think, recently, when it comes to Pillar 2, we talk about our other Five Eye partners, Canada and New Zealand. We hear talk about JAUKUS involving Japan or maybe Korea. Is there a way forward to expand AUKUS, especially on Pillar 2, and how complicated would that be?
Yeah, no, Ray, you were too polite because you just talked about JAUKUS. You didn't talk about caucus. Or at some point, as someone said, if you throw the French in when you can't even pronounce it, it might become an expletive there.
Yeah, we are a family-friendly podcast.
You know, the question is, what's the way forward for more partners here? And I think, you know, let's roll that back, that the initial impetus, at least from my read of AUKUS, is how do we all get to more? And, you know, if you increase the number of pulling at it, you might have even more than the original three. But there's a tension here. And I think this is the main contours of this debate, Ray, which is, on the one hand, of course, we want more players who are going to bring their innovation, bring their know-how, bring their resources and their dollars to developing advanced and emerging technologies. That makes eminent sense. But on the other hand, I think the three AUKUS partners, Australia, the UK, and the US, I wouldn't go so far as to say have been scarred by the AUKUS process, but simply make the point that this is really challenging stuff, even for three of the closest allies who more or less have our security settings synced, who deeply, deeply trust each other, have a very long cultural, historical record of collaborating. But getting our three systems to sync has proven quite challenging. And I think the tension here is obviously, you know, do you want to add more partners on to the endeavor for the know-how and the resources and, frankly, for the kind of diplomatic oomph that they would bring to a broader consortium, or would doing so before AUKUS has taken flight, in Pillar 2, before it's really produced too much in Pillar 1 quite yet, would that overweight the endeavor? And do you first need to produce results amongst the three key partners? So I think that's a tension in AUKUS, but I would note that recent developments suggest that the three governments are thinking about ways to kind of have their cake and eat it too with additional partners. That is, Japan was really early in on this. We saw a joint leader statement back this past spring that said there would be collaborations with Japan potentially and discussions on this. We saw just around the 3-year anniversary, so earlier in September, the announcement of additional consultations between the Kiwis, the Canadians, and the ROCs, the South Koreans, on this, about what an accession process might look like and what would be the requirements to this. Now, one other point here, Ray, I would note that we have a kind of a running series that we've run here at CSIS on AUKUS and the future of the defense and industrial collaboration between Australia, the United States, and the UK. And right after the optimal pathway came out, where all three leaders were in San Diego, California, we had one of the AUKUS leads for the US government come in to chat with our group. And the point that was made at the time was AUKUS is not simply a diplomatic club that you can join. AUKUS is going to be a collaboration that requires inputs, capabilities, willingness to deploy them, and resources. And as much as we love other countries, if you don't meet those requirements, it doesn't really make much sense for us to work with you, particularly on AUKUS. Other areas of defense collaboration, of course, I think figuring out what that means like, what the timeline might be look like, what the checklist needs is where they are right now, while simultaneously trying to work through producing more outputs for Pillar 2.
So the success of Pillar 2 depends ultimately in getting the things produced into the hands of the warfighters. And a big problem, as we know, is if the U.S. doesn't buy it, it probably won't get produced, since we're the big consumer. So it all depends on our procurement policies at the Pentagon, which you know better than I do, tends to be sclerotic, safe. Do you see a change in that approach that will create developments at the speed of our problem as opposed to the speed of the Pentagon?
Yes, no, yes. Sorry, that's a mealy-mouthed answer for you, Jim. Do I see progress on this? I do. I think some of the joint, some of the stuff that's way down in the weeds on AUKUS actually might have outsized impact here, like the joint requirements board that they're now sitting on to make sure that procurement processes, the things that they actually need to get, are aligned between the three systems. Otherwise, it's great if the U.S. acquires something, but if it can't be used for the Brits or for the Aussies, it doesn't really matter in terms of AUKUS. So I do see some real progress forward on this, no less with kind of, it's not in any way the relaxation of security controls. It's kind of the buffering up and the closer alignment of both the British and Australian system to the U.S. system. And frankly, the push into law first, now kind of being meted out across the bureaucratic rules and regulations. It has not yet trickled to culture. That's the place where you have to see about this, about whether or not the United States is more willing to share. Let me note, too, this isn't an, I know people who listen to this know this well, but this is an enormous cultural shift that the United States is trying to undergo. We love our allies and partners. There's no doubt about that. But for the longest of long times, i.e. when we constructed all this stuff during the Cold War, the impetus was to stop the proliferation of sensitive technologies because we were worried about getting it getting into the hands of those who we were most concerned about. We are still quite concerned about that. But now, because of shifts in the global balance of power, because of multiple countries becoming alarmed by the same stimuli, be it China or Russia, what we're now trying to do, and I think AUKUS is the test case here, is trying to make sure that our most trusted allies become the most capable partners that we possibly have in order to play a larger role themselves. That means fundamentally shifting how we've thought about export controls to make sure that our most trusted allies actually have access to some of our most sensitive technologies. Now, there'll be arguments, of course, on the margins, like, we really want that. No, you can't have that yet. That's actually what's playing out right now. But the cultural shift to enabling the sharing of not only information, but technologies is one that I think has shown enormous progress thus far, but that doesn't mean that you take your foot off the wheel, or the gas, rather, at this point.
Well, I can certainly attest from personal experience how difficult it is to share, even with our closest allies, in a culture that prioritizes safety and security and doing the least risky thing possible, which is what bureaucracies do. And I distinctly recall sitting in a room with a four-star American officer, a very senior Australian officer, and complaints that America was not sharing a lot of the things that it said it would share. And the senior American officer said, but I have told my people to do this. And I actually told that four-star officer, the problem is people like me down in the bureaucracy who will always do the thing that is least likely to get us in trouble. And that is not sharing. And so that is a really tough problem. Charlie, it's been really great to see you. And we're coming up on time. Thanks for helping us unpack this really important and complicated issue. But I want to know right now, if people want to follow your work on AUKUS and related U.S.-Australia issues, where can they find it? And where should they follow you?
If they have nothing better to do, Ray, probably the best way to do this is simply just to come to the CSIS Australia Chair landing page. Therefore, you get Jim's insights, you get mine, you get our entire team, Catherine Pack's terrific work on the Pacific too. But for the most part, we've put it there. And if not, the old Google search function works well enough.
All right, Charlie. Again, it's been great to see you. Thanks for coming on today.
Well, as I expected, Charlie gave us a good rundown of why we're here with AUKUS and where it's going and some of the problems remaining. There are a lot of problems we didn't discuss yet, primarily in Australia, with criticisms of whether they're giving up sovereignty and control, the expense, whether the U.S. is a declining nation. All those debates are going on there. But it should be noted that the two major political parties are still fully behind AUKUS. But it's a long way to go, a lot of issues still to discuss.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, maybe one of the big meta issues that, and I appreciate how he brought this out, that gets lost in the discussion is we have a real production and capacity problem that, you know, our normal discussion is not leading us into the solutions for, right? So we're not getting to the fundamental shipbuilding problem that the United States has. But AUKUS is sort of, at least for submarines, is pushing that along by, you know, forcing us to confront the capacity problem, you know, forcing us to look into what are some other places to maintain submarines like Western Australia. You know, so I think in, you know, from a U.S. perspective, this may be elevating the topic to a point where we are actually dealing with it instead of just sort of admiring it.
Yes. Now we're increasing capacity, production capacity and maintenance capacity through AUKUS. And so the criticism of we can't afford to give submarines to Australia, I think over time will pass as more shipyard space.
The flip side is, can we afford not to do this, frankly? Because if we stayed on current glide path, or at least prior to AUKUS glide path, there was not any, you know, obvious solution on the horizon to how we increase production capacity or our maintenance capabilities.
Right. No, it's
well, Jim, I want to give us a chance to respond to a couple of listener questions because, you know, we talk about all the time, we want our listeners to engage. And so I wanted to bring one up, and I wanted to go back to our discussion with you and Graham and Malaysia, because that discussion actually generated quite a bit of comment on our YouTube page, and some of it pretty, you know, honestly, you know, people who, you know, sometimes you worry about are people just reacting to the title. Of course, our titles are meant to be provocative when we start with why should we care. But in some cases, people have actually sat down, they've listened through the whole thing, and they've given their opinion. And I think this one that I pulled out of the group, I think is fairly representative of some of the response that was received from people, from Malaysians, about that discussion. So I think that's important that we elevate that and talk about it a little bit. So here's one. This is from Time for Peace, at Time for Peace on YouTube. The statement that Dr. Graham gave, that Malaysia is having its cake and eating it too, reflects a mentality of the U.S. and the West that Malaysia and supposedly other ASEAN states must choose between China or the U.S. In reality, the ASEAN states want to be friends to all. What frightens these states is being forced to choose, and they just want to be left to grow economically in peace to give their citizens a better life. And it goes on sort of in that vein, but I think that's fairly representative of a lot of the commentary that we saw. How would you respond to this comment?
Well, I think Ewan's argument was the U.S. has a strong economic relationship with Malaysia. The economic relationship between Malaysia and China is even stronger. And so we understand why Malaysia wants to maintain those relationships. However, the question is at what cost? And the cost for Malaysia right now seems to be the inability to develop some of the resources, especially the natural resources in oil and gas, in the South China Sea, even as its current fields start running dry. So I think Ewan's argument was, well, does Malaysia resolve that by not confronting China, or do they confront China? How do they deal with it?
Yeah, so obviously every country along the South China Sea basin and really every country to some degree is faced with the same question, which is, again, China has a list of foreign policy and security imperatives that it is pursuing, and many of those are at the cost of its neighbors. And so Malaysia is one of those neighbors that does, is facing a real cost, and specifically over waters that it claims under international law, and China has counterclaims that challenge that. So, first of all, I think we experience this all the time in diplomatic work, this question of why, who's going to make us choose? And we talked about this in episode one in our pilot podcast. We talked about this issue of don't make us choose. And I think the U.S.'s approach to this has been, and again, especially in your position as chief of mission in Australia, you face this all the time, is we actually sort of put it out there as we don't want to be the ones forcing you to choose. What we want to be is the ones giving you a choice. So, what we see is many of these countries fall under this coercion, and coercion sort of is by nature to the taking away of their choices. And the U.S. wants to be the one out there saying, you do have choices. We can help you secure those choices. Now, does this ultimately fall into what's good for the United States? Of course. Every country acts in its own national interest. U.S. is not, magically benevolent, so that we just, we want what's best for everybody. Ultimately, every country does what's best for that country. But I think that in this case, and in cases like it, you can see an alignment between what the U.S. interests are and what the interests of many of these, in this case, Malaysia's interests are, in terms of upholding the current international order as opposed to yielding to a coercive revisionism coming out of China.
Well, I also note that the phrase making us choose, well, what are we making them do for us? We're saying in your own interests and the U.S. interests as well, we believe you should stand up to China's coercion and aggressive actions. The response to that is don't make us choose. We're not asking you to choose. We're telling you what we think you ought to do. If you don't, we're not changing our policy towards you. We haven't punished anyone for not so-called siding with the U.S. But our job as diplomats and as a country is to encourage countries to do what we believe is in the best interest, as you said, of the U.S., but also we believe of themselves.
Yeah, and again, I appreciate the question, and I get it. I think I get it. Just for, there is a sense in the broader world that these, again, whether they say the elephants are moving around the ring, and the mouse is the one that's going to get trampled, right, or the grass gets trampled, or whatever the saying goes, and they don't want to be the ones trampled. I think there is the reality that you do have to be sensitive to those perspectives, because they live there. They're the ones who have to live in that country, and they have to figure out how to navigate the elephants. at the same time, you can't just sort of wish the elephants away. You know, the so you have to be able to deal with both this localized view that says, let's just let us figure this out. But at the same time, you know, China's ambitions are not going to get less. The more success it has in pushing to the edges of its vast maritime claims in this case, or its, you know, or its ambitions to sort of be the regional hegemon, the more confident it's going to grow to take additional steps. So, you know, this is, I think what we are doing is we're sort of bringing this out and we're saying, hey, you know, you can't ignore this. You can't wish it away. You can't hope that, you know, you can sort of put your head down and it'll all go away and everybody will leave you alone. I mean, it would be great if that were true, but it's just not going to happen that way. And so the question is, how do we move through it in a way that Malaysia, in this case, can have its own interests acknowledged, while at the same time, you know, holding off this extremely aggressive expansionist regime that doesn't seem to be slowing down.
I would also note that, as Yuan kept saying, it's the economic relationship with China that's so important to Malaysia, which I understand. But as the experience of Australia shows, that economic relationship can be manipulated by China. So if I'm a Malaysian businessman, I want to make sure I'm diversified in my export markets because I'm totally dependent on China. I don't know what that elephant may be doing at some point in the future, like China did with Australian coal and barley and wine and lobsters.
Yeah. Sure. So. And yes, and Philippine bananas, and yes, and all of that, exactly. Well, again, I don't want to, this is not a Malaysia show, but I did want to bring that out and just let people know that please do go out to and comment on our videos or our podcasts. We do want to hear from you. We appreciate all the commentary we've got, good, bad, and indifferent, especially if we know that you've listened through it and you've considered the arguments, more power to you if you disagree with us. You absolutely should vocalize that. But we thank our producer, Ian, for helping us get these out. We always want to give him a shout out at Ian Ellis Jones on X to see his great work that's getting more and more attention all the time. Please, if you haven't subscribed, go to youtube.com/IP Podcast and you can subscribe there or whatever streaming service, Apple, Spotify, Amazon, whatever streaming service you use to download our audio podcast, go there, give us 5 stars. unless you totally disagree with us, and then we don't want to hear from you at all. Seriously, but thanks again for joining us today. Let's talk again very soon on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific.